Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1105. Fascism, 2019 World Tour, Part 15. Lithium coup in Bolivia, Part 2. This is being recorded on December 19th of the year 2019. We are going to be continuing with our analysis of, at one level, a coup d'etat that ousted Evo Morales as president of Brazil. That was a coup d'etat that, at a domestic level, a Bolivian domestic level, involved some members of the Bolivian elite who, not surprisingly, were involved with some of the lucrative development of Bolivian natural resources, natural gas, and real estate, and, as we will see in our next shows, minerals as well. They, in turn, were heavily networked with various fascist organizations in Bolivia. The UJC, a right-wing Christian fascist organization in the Santa Cruz area, which also was networked with the Bolivian Socialist Falange, a fascist group that had hosted Klaus Barbie. And in turn, we looked at the networking between those domestic elitists and fascists and European fascists, some of whom participated in an attempted coup, or an attempted assassination, I should say, of Evo Morales in 2009. Branko Marinković, a Croatian-Bolivian oligarch, was one of the financiers of that, and that coup attempt also had, that assassination attempt also had apparent financing from some U.S.-linked organizations as well. There were elements of U.S. intelligence linked to that, elements of the transnational community that were linked to the destabilization of Morales, and also there was support for Mr. Camacho and Mr. Marinković and the elements who ousted Morales from other right-wing Latin American forces and leaders, including people in Venezuela, Colombia, and Brazil as well. For background on this, I would recommend that people use the website, in particular the Anti-Fascist Archives, or AFA series. That is a long series that I did primarily in the 1980s, and the AFA programs 17 through 21, numbers 17 and 19 in particular, will be of considerable use in this. And again, I recommend to listeners that they use the descriptions for this program and for these programs, because this is sort of a hybrid form of broadcasting, and it is not easy to transition from the printed word and the tones of academic research, or the halls of academic research, and the electronic airwaves, but I'm doing the best that I can. We are going to continue with a reading of a paper from The Gray Zone of November 11th of 2019. It is co-authored by Max Blumenthal, B-L-U-M-E-N-T-H-A-L, and Ben Norton. Headline, Bolivia Coup, led by Christian fascist paramilitary leader and multimillionaire with foreign support. And we have been reading from this article, and we are going to continue, and I'm going to overlap this somewhat with the material in our last program by way of continuity. We were talking about the international assassination plot against Evo Morales, apparently financed in part by Branko Marinković, the wealthy Croatian/Bolivian oligarch. And one of the main people in that was a Bolivian leftist turned fascist named Eduardo Rosa Flores, who had been Molvigar Franco after Generalissimo Francisco Franco of Spain, and the speculation that Branko Marinković may have been of Ustashi, Croatian Ustashi lineage, was lent more gravitas from the fact that Mr. Rosa had been networking with the fascists from Hungary and Croatia, and he had apparently fought with the Croatian First International Platoon, or PIV, in the Croatian, in the Yugoslavian civil wars that followed the breakup of Yugoslavia and the establishment of Croatia as not only an independent country, but one governed in considerable measure, as we looked at for the records on 902, by Neo-Ustashi. That was 901, but the link will be in the description for this program. Note again that the Vatican networks, Mr. Rosa Flores was a member of Opus Dei. Opus Dei also, and the Vatican, very supportive of the Croatian Ustashi as well. AFA program number 17, giving good background on the support of the Vatican for fascism. Of Mr. Marinković and the coup of the assassination attempt in 2009 against Morales, he ultimately was ousted 10 years later, earlier this year. Marinković was subsequently charged with providing $200,000 to the plotters. The Bolivian-Croatian oligarch initially fled to the U.S., where he was given asylum, then relocated to Brazil, where he lives today. He denied any involvement in the plan to kill Morales, as journalist Matt Kennard, K-E-N-N-A-R-B, reported. There was another thread that tied the plot to the U.S., the alleged participation of an NGO leader named Hugo Achamelgao. Quote, Rosa didn't come here by himself. They brought him, the Bolivian government's lead investigator told Kennard. Hugo Achamelgao brought him, unquote. Acha was not just the head of any run-of-the-mill NGO. He had founded the Bolivian subsidiary of the Human Rights Foundation, or HRF, an international right-wing outfit that is known for hosting a, quote, school for revolution, unquote, for activists seeking regime change in states targeted by the U.S. government. HRF is run by Thor Halverson Jr., the son of the late Venezuelan oligarch and CIA asset Thor Halverson Helum, H-E-L-L-U-M. The first cousin of the veteran Venezuelan coup plotter Leopoldo López, Halverson was a former college Republican activist who crusaded against political correctness and other familiar right-wing hobgoblins. After a brief career as a firebrand right-wing film producer, in which he oversaw a scandalous anti-environmentalist documentary financed by a mining corporation, Halverson rebranded as a promoter of liberalism and the enemy of global authoritarianism. He launched the HRF with grants from right-wing billionaires like Peter Thiel, conservative foundations, and NGOs, including Amnesty International. The group has since been at the forefront of training activists for insurrectionary activity from Hong Kong to the Middle East to Latin America. Though Acha was granted asylum in the U.S., the HRF has continued pushing regime change in Bolivia. As a Wyatt Reid reported for the Gray Zone, HRF, quote, freedom fellow, unquote, Janice Vaca Daza, D-A-Z-A, helped triggered the initial stage of the coup by blaming Morales for the Amazon fires that consumed parts of Bolivia in August, mobilizing international protests against him. At the time, Daza posed as an environmental activist, unquote, and student of nonviolence who articulated her concerns in moderate-seeming calls for more international aid to Bolivia. Through her NGO Rios de Pie, R-I-O-S, small B-E, capital P-I-E, she helped launch the hashtag SOS Bolivia hashtag, which signaled the imminent foreign-backed regime change operation. While HRS DASA rallied protests outside Bolivian embassies in Europe and the U.S., Fernando Camacho remained behind the scenes, lobbying right-wing governments in the region to bless the coming coup. In May, Camacho met with Colombia's far-right president, Iván Duque. Camacho was helping to spearhead regional efforts at undermining the legitimacy of Evo Morales' presidency at the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, seeking to block his candidacy in the October election. That same month, the rightist Bolivian agitator also met with Ernesto Araujo, A-R-A-U-J-O, the chancellor of Jair Bolsonaro's ultra-conservative administration in Brazil. Through the meeting, Camacho successfully secured Bolsonaro's backing for regime change in Bolivia. This past November 10th, that was the day before the article published, Araujo enthusiastically endorsed the ouster of Morales, declaring that, quote, Brazil will support the democratic and constitutional transition, unquote, in the country. Then, in August, 2 months before Bolivia's presidential election, Camacho held court with officials from Venezuela's U.S.-appointed coup regime. These included Gustavo Tarre, Guaido's faux Venezuelan OAS ambassador, who formerly worked at the right-wing Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS, think tank in Washington. After the meeting, Camacho tweeted gratitude to the Venezuelan coup mongers as well as to Colombia and Brazil. Back in Bolivia, Carlos Mesa occupied the spotlight as the opposition's presidential candidate. His erudite image and centrist policy proposals put him in a seemingly alternate political universe from fire-breathing rightists like Camacho and Marinkovic. For them, he was a convenient frontman and acceptable candidate who promised to defend their economic interests. It might be that he is not my favorite, but I'm going to vote for him because I don't want Evo, unquote, Marinkovic told a right-wing Argentine newspaper 5 days before the election. Indeed, it was Camacho's practical financial interests that appeared to have necessitated his support for Mesa. The Camacho family has formed a natural gas cartel in Santa Cruz. As the Bolivian outlet Primera Linea reported, Luis Fernando Camacho's father, José Luis, was the owner of a company called Sergas that distributed gas in the city. His uncle Enrique controlled Socre, capital S-O-C-R-E, the company that ran the local gas production facilities, and his cousin, Christian, controls another local gas distributor called Controgas, C-O-N-D-R-O-G-A-S with a capital C. According to Primera Linea, the Camacho family was using the pro-Santa Cruz committee as a political weapon to install Carlos Mesa into power and ensure the restoration of their business empire. Mesa has a well-documented history of advancing the goals of transnational companies at the expense of his own country's population. The neoliberal politician and media personality served as vice president when the U.S.-backed President Gonzalo Gómez Sánchez de Lozada provoked mass protests with his 2003 plan to allow a consortium of multinational corporations to export the country's natural gas to the U.S. through a Chilean port. Bolivia's U.S.-trained security forces met the ferocious protests with brutal repression. After presiding over the killing of 70 unarmed protesters, Sanchez de Lozada fled to Miami and was succeeded by Mesa. By 2005, Mesa was also ousted by huge demonstrations spurred by his protection of privatized natural gas companies. With his demise, the election of Morales and the rise of the socialist and rural indigenous movements behind him were just beyond the horizon. U.S. government cables show that after his ouster, Mesa continued regular correspondence with American officials. A 2008 memo from the U.S. Embassy in Bolivia revealed that Washington was conspiring with opposition politicians in the lead-up to the 2009 presidential election, hoping to undermine and ultimately unseat Morales. The memo noted that Mesa had met with the chargé d'affaires of the U.S. Embassy and had privately told them that he planned to run for president. The cable recalled, Mesa told us his party would be ideologically similar to a social democratic party, and that he hoped to strengthen ties with the Democratic Party. Quote, we have nothing against the Republican Party and have, in fact, gotten support from IRI, the International Republican Institute, in the past, but we think we share more ideology with the Democrats, unquote, he added. Today, Mesa serves as an in-house expert, unquote, at the Inter-American Dialogue, a neoliberal Washington-based think tank focused on Latin America. One of the Dialogue's top donors is the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the State Department subsidiary that was exposed in classified diplomatic cables for strategically directing millions of dollars to opposition groups, including those, quote, opposed to Evo Morales' vision for indigenous communities. Other top funders of the Dialogue include oil titans like Chevron and ExxonMobil. Bechtel, which inspired the initial protests against the administration in which Mesa served, the Inter-American Development Bank, which has forcefully opposed Morales' socialist-oriented policies, and the Organization of American States, or OAS, which helped delegitimize the Morales re-election victory with dubious claims of irregular vote counts. This last sentence again. Other top funders of the Inter-American Dialogue include oil titans like Chevron and ExxonMobil, Bechtel, which inspired the initial protests against the administration in which Mesa served, the Inter-American Development Bank, which has forcefully opposed Morales' socialist-oriented policies, and the Organization of American States, which helped delegitimize the Morales re-election victory with dubious claims of irregular vote counts. And what we're going to note next is the role of the mineral lithium in not only the Bolivian economy, but also in the global economy. And in particular, we are going to take a look in our next couple of articles at the dynamics concerning international development of Bolivia's lithium reserves. Now, Bolivia has, by some accounts, up to 70% of the world's lithium. Lithium is a critical mineral for the manufacture of electric batteries, the batteries for electric cars in particular. The expenses involved in the production of batteries for electric cars constitutes something like 30 to 50% of a very large percent of the actual cost of manufacturing an electric car. This obviously places the Bolivian lithium industry right in the middle of the dynamic, the global dynamic for the manufacture of electric vehicles, and also for the production of green technology. I will also note that lithium is deeply involved with, lithium is a critical component, I should say, for the batteries used in a lot of laptop computers as well. So lithium, a fundamental element and one that is very, very important for the development of green industries. Now, in that regard, China had, which is the global leader in green industries, as we have seen, was not only jockeying for a position to help develop Bolivia's lithium reserves, but have apparently worked out a paradigm which would have been much more local friendly, to coin the term. It would have been much better for locals in the area, for the economy of that area, and for the people involved there. Previously, the Morales government had agreed with a German firm that enjoyed very significant backing from the German government to develop Bolivia's lithium reserves. However, protests from the locals eventually convinced Evo Morales to cancel the contract with the German firm and to incline him in the direction of collaboration with Chinese firms for the development of Bolivia's lithium reserves. This, as the author of the article we're going to read, Vijay Prashad, noted, this placed Bolivia right in the crosshairs of the global destabilization effort against China. I will also note, as we will see, that the German company that was supposed to be exploiting Bolivia's lithium reserves had received heavy backing from the German government. One of the things that has been cited as a justification for economic warfare against China. And this is, you know, not to say that China is a day at the beach. When you have a country that large, roughly 1.5 billion people, and when they have made as much progress as they have in 1981, 88% of the Chinese population was in poverty, and according to the World Bank, by 2015 that was at 0.7%. That was a remarkable degree of progress. And their middle class was at 4% of the population in 2002. And by last year, it was up to 31%. That was roughly an eightfold increase in the Chinese middle class in less than two decades. That is a remarkable degree of progress. And the fact of the matter is, you cannot make that much progress, that fast, with that big a country, without having some rather sharp elbows, shall we say. And an article that we read from the Consortium News in one of our earlier shows noted that there have been all sorts of strikes and protests around China. I don't doubt that at all. And there are many things about the country that need to be improved. Unlike the U.S., which is a day at the beach. Now, we don't have any improvement. That is sarcastic. China is going in the right direction. We are going in the wrong direction. And China is the world leader in green technologies, and we are going full speed astern in that regard. But again, one of the kicks against China is that their government backs many of their commercial institutions. That is quite true. China might be termed state capitalism. The same is certainly true of Germany, and We'll ruminate perhaps about China a little more later. But note in connection with lithium and with Bolivia, the German firm that was going to be developing the Bolivian lithium reserves and which may now be, in fact, going to develop the Bolivian lithium reserves received heavy backing from the German government. That is the kick they're making against China. I would note that now the Trump Federal Communications Commission has voted to approve the merger between Sprint and T-Mobile, creating the largest American wireless carrier. I believe it's the largest, maybe the second largest, but it certainly is a huge, huge merger. T-Mobile is a controlling interest in T-Mobile. The parent company of that is Deutsche Telekom. A controlling interest in that is the German government. And I would note that in addition to T-Mobile, they also control the MetroPCS, by the way, is owned by T-Mobile, which is owned by Deutsche Controlling Interest. No, it's a subsidiary of Deutsche Telekom. The German government is the majority owner of Deutsche Telekom, T-Mobile, MetroPCS, and now the merger of T-Mobile and Sprint. That is state capitalism, folks.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Now, about Bolivia and lithium and how lithium loomed in the coup in Bolivia, this is from the Common Dreams blog of November 12th of 2019 by Vijay Prashad, capital V-I-J-A-Y, capital P-R-A-S-H-A-B. After Morales ousted in coup, the lithium question looms large in Bolivia. Bolivia's President Evo Morales was overthrown in a military coup on November 10th. He is now in Mexico, but before he left office, Morales had been involved in a long project to bring economic and social democracy to his long-exploited country. It is important to recall that Bolivia had suffered a series of coups, often conducted by the military and the oligarchy on behalf of transnational mining companies. Initially, these were tin firms, but tin is no longer the main target in Bolivia. The main target is its massive deposits of lithium, crucial for the electric car, parenthetically also for laptops. Over the past 13 years, Morales has tried to build a different relationship between his country and its resources. He has not wanted the resources to benefit the transnational mining firms, but rather to benefit his own population. Part of that promise was met as Bolivia's poverty rate has declined and as Bolivia's population was able to improve its social indicators. Nationalization of resources combined with the use of its income to fund social development has played a role. The attitude of the Morales government toward the transnational firms produced a harsh response from them, many of them taking Bolivia to court. The idea that there might be a new social compact for the lithium was unacceptable to the main transnational mining companies. Over the course of the past few years, Bolivia has struggled to raise investment to develop the lithium reserves in a way that brings the wealth back into the country for its people. Morales' Vice President Alvaro Garcia Linera has said that lithium is the, quote, fuel that will feed the world, unquote. Bolivia was unable to make deals with Western transnational firms. It decided to partner with Chinese firms. This made the Morales government vulnerable. It had walked into the new Cold War between the West and China. The coup against Morales cannot be understood without a glance at this clash. when Evo Morales and the Movement for Socialism took power in 2006. The government immediately sought to undo decades of theft by transnational mining firms. Morales' government seized several of the mining operations of the most powerful firms, such as Glencore, Jindal, Steel and Power, Anglo-Argentine Pan American Energy, and South American Silver, now Trimetals Mining. It sent a message that business as usual was not going to continue. Nonetheless, these large firms continued their operations based on older contracts in some areas of the country. For example, the Canadian transnational firm South American Silver had created the company in 2003 before Morales came to power to mine the Malku Kota for silver and indium, a rare earth metal used in flat screen televisions. South American Silver then began to extend its reach into its concessions. The land that it claimed was inhabited by indigenous Bolivians, who argued that the company was destroying its sacred spaces as well as promoting an atmosphere of violence. On August 1st, 2012, the Morales government, by Supreme Decree No. 1308, annulled the contract with South American Silver or Trimetals Mining, which then sought international arbitration and compensation. Canada's government of Justin Trudeau, as part of a broader push on behalf of Canadian mining companies in South America, put an immense amount of pressure on Bolivia. In August of 2019, Trimetals struck a deal with the Bolivian government for $25.8 million, about a tenth of what it had earlier demanded as compensation. Jindal Steel, an Indian transnational corporation, had an old contract to mine iron ore from Bolivia's El Mutun, M-U-T-U-N, a contract that was put on hold by the Morales government in 2007. In July of 2012, Jindal Steel terminated the contract and sought international arbitration and compensation for its investment. In 2014, it won $22.5 million from Bolivia in a ruling from Paris-based International Chamber of Commerce. For another case against Bolivia, Jindal Steel demanded $100 million in compensation. The Morales government seized three facilities from the Swiss-based transnational mining firm Glencore. These included a tin and zinc mine, as well as two smelters. The mine's expropriation took place after Glencore's subsidiary clashed violently with miners. Most aggressively, Pan American sued the Bolivian government for $1.5 billion for the expropriation of the Anglo-Argentinian company's stake in natural gas producer Chaco by the state. Bolivia settled for $357 million in 2014. The scale of these payouts is enormous. It was estimated in 2014 that the public and private payments made for nationalization of these key sectors amounted to at least $1.9 billion. Bolivia's GDP was at that time $28 billion. In 2014, even the Financial Times agreed that Morales' strategy was not entirely inappropriate. Quote, proof of the success of Morales' economic model is that since coming to power, he has tripled the size of the economy while ramping up record foreign reserves. Bolivia's key reserves are in lithium, which is essential for the electric car. Bolivia claims to have 70% of the world's lithium reserves, mostly in the Salar de Uyuni sulfides, that's capital S-A-L-A-R-D-E, capital U-Y-U-N-I, I am probably butchering many of these pronunciations. The complexity of the mining and processing has meant that Bolivia has not been able to develop the lithium industry on its own. It requires capital, and it requires expertise. The Salt Flat is at about 12,000 feet or 5,600 meters above sea level, and it receives high rainfall. This makes it difficult to use sun-based evaporation. Such simpler solutions are available to Chile's Atacama Desert and in Argentina's Hombre Muerto. More technical solutions are needed for Bolivia, which means that more investment is needed. The nationalization policy of the Morales government and the geographical complexity of Salar de Uyuni chased away several transnational firms. Eramet from France, FMC of the U.S., and POSCO, South Korea, could not make deals with Bolivia, so they now operate in Argentina. Morales made it clear that any development of the lithium had to be done with Bolivia's COMIBOL, that's capital C-O-M-I-B-O-L, its national mining company, and Yacimientos de Litio Bolivianos, or YLB, its national lithium company, as equal partners. Note the following. Last year, Germany's ACI systems, that's A as in Apple, C as in Cat, I as in India. Last year, Germany's ACI systems agreed to a deal with Bolivia. After protests from residents in the Salar de Uyuni region, Morales canceled that deal on November 4th of 2019. Chinese firms such as TBEA Group and China Machinery Engineering made a deal with YLB instead. It was being said that China's Chunky Lithium Group, which operates in Argentina, was going to make a deal with YLB. Both Chinese investment and the Bolivian lithium company were experimenting with new ways to both mine the lithium and to share the profits of the lithium. This is fundamental here. Both Chinese investment and the Bolivian lithium company were experimenting with new ways to both mine the lithium and to share the profits of the lithium. The idea that there might be a new social compact for the lithium was unacceptable to the main transnational mining companies. Tesla Motors of the U.S. and Pure Energy Minerals of Canada both showed great interest in having a direct stake in Bolivian lithium. But they could not make a deal that would take into consideration the parameters set by the Morales government. Morales himself was a direct impediment to the takeover of the lithium fields by the non-Chinese transnational firms. He had to go. After the coup, Tesla's stock rose astronomically. So again, initially, ACI, the heavily German government-backed German firm, had agreed to develop the lithium in the Salar, again, capital S-A-L-A-R-D-E, capital U-Y-U-N-I region. I'm probably butchering that pronunciation. However, Morales canceled that deal because locals protested that it would not do enough for them. Then again, the Chinese companies began negotiating with Morales. Both Chinese investment and the Bolivian lithium company were experimenting with new ways to both mine the lithium and to share the profits of the lithium. The idea that there might be a new social compact for the lithium was unacceptable to the main transnational mining companies, as was no doubt the fact that it would be the Chinese, already the world's leaders in green technology, that would be working on this. Now, of the ACI German firm that contracted to develop the Bolivian lithium. This from Reuters of January 12th of 2018. Germany secures access to vast lithium deposit in Bolivia by Michael Niemeyer, capital N-I-E-M-A-B-E-R. Bear in mind that Bolivia canceled that contract. This reads, Germany and Bolivia on Wednesday sealed a partnership for the industrial use of lithium, a key raw material for battery cell production, in an important step to become less dependent on Asian market leaders in the dawning age of electric cars. Interest in battery metals such as cobalt, nickel, and lithium is soaring as the auto industry scrambles to build more electric cars and cut noxious fumes from vehicles powered by fossil fuels in light of stricter emission rules. Quote, Germany should become a leading location for battery cell production. A large part of production costs is linked to raw materials, unquote, German Economy Minister Peter Altmaier said, again quoting, German industry is therefore well advised to secure its needs for lithium early in order to avoid falling behind and slipping into dependency, Altmaier said, adding the deal was, quote, an important building block, unquote, to secure this supply. With the joint venture, Bolivian state company YLB is teaming up with Germany's privately owned ACI Systems to develop its massive Uyuni salt flat and build a lithium hydroxide plant as well as a factory for electric vehicle batteries in Bolivia. ACI Systems is also in talks to supply companies based in Germany and elsewhere in Europe with lithium from Bolivia. The joint venture aims to produce up to 40,000 tons of lithium hydroxide per year from 2022 on over a period of 70 years. Wolfgang Schmutz, S-C-H-M-U-T-Z, CEO of ACI Group, the parent company of ACI Systems, said more than 80% of the lithium will be exported to Germany. ACI Systems is in talks to supply a big German car maker with lithium, according to a person familiar with the project. One more time. ACI Systems is in talks to supply a big German car maker with lithium, according to a person familiar with the project. An ACI Systems spokeswoman declined to comment. For Germany, the public-private partnership is part of wider efforts to support the production of battery cells in Europe and help companies get more control over the value-added chain of electric vehicles. The government has earmarked 1 billion euros to support domestic companies looking to produce battery cells for electric vehicles as a way to reduce German carmakers' dependence on Asian suppliers and protect jobs at risk from the shift away from combustion engines. For Bolivia, the deal to extract lithium from the Uyuni sulfates in the Andes, one of the world's largest deposits, enables the government to bring jobs to a region plagued by poverty. Nicole Hofmeister Kraut, you know, some of this you can't make up. This is actually her name. Nicole Hofmeister Kraut, that's H-O-F-F-M-E-I-S-T-E-R hyphen Kraut, as in Kraut, economy minister of Germany's southwestern state of Baden-Württemberg, the home region of SACI Systems, said the lithium deal would help German carmakers to become less dependent on Asian suppliers of car batteries. The success of the venture now depends on whether both sides can reconcile economic interests with environmental and social requirements. President Evo Morales has sought to keep lithium from being exported merely as raw material, and Germany's willingness to help build production facilities in Bolivia played a key role in the decision to start the venture. When Bolivia sought a foreign partner to develop Uyuni, a Chinese company seemed a natural fit, given China's dominance in the global lithium supply chain and its strong ties with La Paz. Instead, Bolivia picked ACI Systems, a company from southern Germany untested in lithium that nonetheless beat seven rivals from China, Russia, and Canada. Backing from German federal and regional ministries was key to persuading Bolivia ACI's bid was serious, company and government officials from Bolivia and Germany told Reuters one more time. Backing from German federal and regional ministries was key to persuading Bolivia ACI's bid was serious, company and government officials from Bolivia and Germany told Reuters. And noting that, again, just after the ousting of Morales, Tesla's stock shot way, way up. Bear in mind, too, that Elon Musk grew up in apartheid-era South Africa. The Brundibond, the dominant element, political element in the South African apartheid government, was a direct offshoot of the German Nazi Party, as we looked at in Miscellaneous Archive Show number 8 and other programs.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Another Reuters story, this from November 14th of 2019, began just after the Bolivian coup. German automation talent powers Musk's battery move to Europe by Edward Taylor. To unclog bottlenecks last year at his Tesla Incorporated plant in California, Elon Musk flew in 6 plane loads of new robots and equipment from Germany to speed up battery production for its Model 3. Now the Tesla CEO is trying to tap that German automation ecosystem directly with Tuesday's announcement that the electric car maker will build a European car and battery factory near Berlin. So far, Musk has failed in his plans to create a factory so highly automated that it allows Tesla to make cars more efficiently than much bigger rivals. As a result, the automaker has struggled to meet production goals and has been hit with defections of key staff members to rival firms. The new German factory is designed to help change all that. Quote, "Everyone knows German engineering is outstanding, for sure. You know that is part of the reason why we are locating Gigafactory Europe in Germany," Musk said at a prestigious German car awards ceremony in Berlin late on Tuesday. BMW has a factory in Leipzig where it builds its i3 electric vehicle, and it will source battery cells from a factory in Erfurt run by China's contemporary Ampex Technology Limited. VW is retooling a plant in Zwickau to build 330,000 electric cars, and German engineering plant Siemens AG, which has an industrial and technology hub in Berlin last week, said it met with Musk to discuss projects in the area of advanced manufacturing and car charging. German car makers and suppliers are tapping into a 1 billion euro fund set up by Germany to increase battery cell production and are further aided by a government-funded research facility to increase battery cell development know-how. Tesla has yet to meet its goal of building more than 500,000 Model 3 cars by 2018. That goal was set back in 2016, and since then Tesla's production guru, Peter Hochholdinger, a former Audi production expert, quit to join rival Lucid. This year, Tesla expects to deliver 360,000 to 400,000 cars, a target that includes selling all models. By contrast, the Volkswagen brand delivered 6.24 million cars last year and is readying its global production network to build 22 million electric cars by 2028. To ramp up manufacturing, Tesla started making its Model 3 in a tent, but the California-built cars often failed to meet German quality standards. In August, German car rental company Nextmove walked away from a 5 million euro order for 85 Tesla Model 3 electric vehicles following a dispute over how to fix quality issues. Although Tesla has chosen a high-cost location, there is higher potential for automation with electric cars since they are less complex to build than combustion engine vehicles. A combustion engine car has 1,400 components in the motor, exhaust system, and transmission. By contrast, an electric car's battery and motor has only 200 components, according to analysts at ING. While the average combustion engine takes 3.5 hours to make and the average transmission requires 2.7 hours of assembly, an electric motor takes only about 1 hour to assemble, consultants at Alex, ALIX Partners, said in their Global Automotive Outlook study. Quote, personnel is not a high-cost factor in the production of electric cars, unquote, Evercore ISI analyst Arndt Ellinghorst said. Today, the biggest cost factor is still battery packs, which amount to between 30 and 50% of the cost of an electric vehicle. By adding the Made in Germany quality, Tesla could significantly boost sales of its electric cars, which are already class-leading. On Tuesday, Tesla's Model 3 was awarded the Golden Steering Wheel by Germany's Auto Bild magazine, with jury member Robin Horning saying the Model 3 had beaten the new BMW 3 Series and the Audi A4 in, quote, mid- and premium class category. So, just after the coup in Bolivia, Tesla's stock shoots up, and a few days later, Tesla decides to establish a electric car building factory in Germany. Now, note again, Germany's position in green industry, reviewing quickly part of an op-ed column from the New York Times from December 10th of 2019, Our Green Energy Challenge by John Kerry and Ro Khanna. We aren't winning the clean energy race today. In many ways, we aren't even trying. China is becoming an energy superpower. Earlier this year, the Global Commission on the Geopolitics of the Energy Transformation reported that China became the world's largest producer, exporter, and installer of solar panels, wind turbines, batteries, and electric vehicles, followed by Japan and Germany. The U.S. ranks fourth. China surpassed us for the lead in renewable energy technology, too, with 150,000 patents, making up to 30% of the world's total. We are second with just over 100,000 patents, while Japan and the European Union follow with about 75,000 each. In 2015, China surpassed us to become the largest electric vehicle market and is on pace to dominate production for the next 20 years. Chinese electric vehicles account for 60% of global sales. 876,000 vehicles were produced last year, compared with 361,000 in America. China is doing things we are afraid to do. They offer citizens large subsidies for purchasing electric vehicles from state-owned companies. Municipalities waive fees for electric vehicle owners. The city of Shenzhen, for example, which has a population of 12.5 million people, runs a 100% electric vehicle bus fleet and is, by fiat, converting 22,000 taxis to electric vehicles. High-speed rail is also integral to China's strategy. It has the largest high-speed rail network, high-speed railway in the world, with 19,000 miles of track and most major cities connected by the network. The U.S. has less than 500 miles. Our fastest train takes 19 to 22 hours from New York to Chicago, whereas the same distance in China takes 4.5 hours. And again, I think it is more than a little interesting that Emerdata, a British-based firm combining Cambridge Analytica and SCL, and with one of the directors being a Hong Kong financier, Johnson Ko Chun Sun, a business partner of Eric Prince. I think that is more than a little interesting, and with Steve Bannon at the epicenter of the American anti-Chinese effort, I think the unrest in Hong Kong once again deserves deeper scrutiny in light of the paradigm that was laid out by Christopher Wiley as to how Cambridge Analytica, borrowing on SCL's activities, uses social media to develop an insurgency, using disinformation. With 20% of the Hong Kong population in poverty because of the astronomical rise in rents and the stagnation of the economy, a lot of young Hong Kong people, a lot of young Hong Kongers would basically be quite susceptible, I think, to that kind of disinformation. Also, bearing in mind something we looked at from the Cryptome blog, emails from WikiLeaks revealing that Chinese, quote, dissidents, unquote, and Tibetans were deeply involved with the formation of WikiLeaks, and mentioning that China was one of the major targets of WikiLeaks. In that regard, Edward Snowden's initial decampment in combination with WikiLeaks and BBG CIA associate Jacob Applebaum from Hawaii to Hong Kong, where he hooks up with Sarah Harrison and WikiLeaks, goes from Hong Kong to Moscow to begin the new Cold War. What was Eddie Snowden doing in Hong Kong? What perhaps might Jacob Applebaum have been doing there as well? Again, I think the activities of WikiLeaks beginning in 2010, they declassified, they put a bunch of U.S. State Department cables at the time that Hillary Clinton is head of the U.S. State Department. She is Secretary of State. And at the same time that her State Department and Barack Obama's State Department is engaged in their reboot with Russia. Remember that? Kind of hard to remember in light of the fog of disinformation since, and by the way, Hillary Clinton has gotten sucked into that big time. But in 2010, WikiLeaks publishes all of the State Department cables, basically confirming what anyone would have been able to conclude, which was that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were not leftists. In 2010, the Republicans regain control of the House of Representatives. Then in 2013, Eddie Snowden engages in his world tour, initially stopping in Hong Kong, courtesy of WikiLeaks, well, really going from Hawaii to Hong Kong to Russia, courtesy of Jacob Applebaum and WikiLeaks. That begins the new Cold War, and the disclosures further erode the belief in the Obama administration among young people. Then in 2014, the Republicans regain control of the Senate. Again, I think a lot of things need to be reexamined. However, we're going to have to do that in the future. I'm going to take a couple of weeks off for the holidays. This concludes For the Record program number 1105, Fascism 2019 World Tour Part 15, Lithium Coup in Bolivia Part 2, This is being recorded on December 17th, 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have a happy New Year.